Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. On today's episodes, Pete Dorman and I talk our best of the year, games, surprises, transfers, players. We've got the best of football action in 2022. Then it's on to the burn book with the things we loved, slash didn't hate, and despised over the last week. While over on the paid side, we take a look at Cody Gakpo to Liverpool, and we look at our anything but football picks of the year, from films and experiences to the biggest idiots of 2022. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. Okay, so hello everybody and welcome back to the podcast. It's a special, I consider this a bonus episode because it's coming between Christmas and New Year when neither one of us is working. Pete, you're joining me from Northern Ireland. How are you doing?
I'm very excited for the first ever Unseen Incidents international episode.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Well, I suppose multinational, depending on your political allegiances.
Well, your political allegiances, I think, are a lot clearer than mine in this scenario.
A lot of people in this country would believe this to be a completely different country to the country you're in, which is England. Mm-hmm. Whereas my political allegiances would have me believe that this country is a devolved state. And well, it legally is a devolved state of your country.
Well, let's not say my country. Let's say the country I'm in, to be clear.
The country you're currently in, yes.
Look. It's one of those difficult situations because always with these things, you want to say, you know what? Like, I just take a back seat in this argument. Let people decide for themselves.
Yeah.
But you kind of can't do that with Northern Ireland. You piss somebody off one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, you've just never been more Zimbabwean / Dutch in this conversation, right?
Yeah, I'm so neutral right now. You know what? I just want everyone to be happy.
Yeah.
Except the English. I mean, they'll never be happy. And I think that's kind of their strength. How's your Christmas been?
My Christmas has been lovely. It's been quite busy. We've been from London. We spent Christmas Day in Bath with Jess's family and my mum. Now we're back in Northern Ireland for a week. And then we are flying back to London at the start of January and going straight to the office from the airport on a day where the trains are striking. So that's going to be just a lovely welcome back to the office, welcome back to full-time working life, kicking the teeth. Fuck you, Christmas is done. But that's next year's problem. So yes, I'm enjoying my time off, even though it's busy. How has your Christmas been? Where are you?
I'm on the south coast. I'm in West Sussex. So it's nice. I'm by the seaside, which is fun because my daughter can say seaside. But in a way, holidays are as hard work as actual work, in the, you know, when the baby gets up, you kind of then do childcare for the day. And here it's better because we have my wife's family to help out. But it means that you're never fully kind of off. So actually, when I go back to work in January, it won't feel as much of a punch in the face because at least it's...
Because those punches had never stopped.
Yes, exactly. And also, you kind of... If you don't put in 100% at your day job, that's fine. If you don't put in 100% with your child, you kind of feel like a dick.
So you're actually working twice as hard as you usually do then, by that math.
Yeah, I'm doing work plus investment, emotional investment, which I've always prided myself on not doing previously. But yeah, it's good. It's good. And it's kind of fun because like now she's 1.5. She kind of gets Christmas. She motors around, or she doesn't get Christmas fully, but like she wants to put the lights on the tree. She's got new presents that she understands are fun. Like she sat at the table with us and had a Christmas dinner / she just ate roast potatoes. So
I love it.
All this kind of stuff is really fun.
A young woman after my own heart, roasted potatoes. Fuck the rest. Well, the rest is good, but yeah.
I had to trick her into eating a pig in blanket, though. Like, what's up with that?
How do you trick a one-year-old?
Sometimes you offer to give them one thing, and then you poke the other thing into their little mouth. Like, so you're like, oh,
well,
a potato.
Like you're waving a potato in front of her while,
yeah,
putting a pig in blanket in.
Yeah, Or sometimes you're just playing around and she pops her little mouth open to show you her teeth or something, which she likes to do. She's very proud of her teeth. And then you kind of like put in a pig in blanket and then she's like, oh, this is good. And then she wants more. So today, for instance, Emma made scones and Coco would not eat this fucking scone. Like she made one tiny scone for Coco and Coco would not eat it. And I was like, this is madness. Eventually managed to poke some into her mouth while she was shouting. Suddenly couldn't get enough of the scones. Wanted to eat all the scones.
The not to get too much into this, but the scone for Coco was a fully formed, just smaller version of the actual scone. Yeah,
that's exactly correct.
That seems kind of unnecessary, given you could have just cut up a normal scone.
Yeah, but have you met
my
wife?
Yeah, I have. I really appreciate it. I love the effort and I imagine it was very, very cute, but if that was me, I would have just cut up a normal scone.
I know, but then also, if Emma had asked me to give her Coco a fragment of my scone, I would have loved both of them slightly less. So it was for the best that we did it this way, I would say. But she'll never know. She'll never know. Let's move on. Let's move on to some football then, shall we? Because on this first episode today, we're going to talk about our best football things of the year. You know, our player of the year, our surprise of the year, loads of good stuff in there. And then over on the paid side, post-burn book, we're going to take a look at that big transfer and also do some of our cultural picks. So starting off with our best of the year, I thought we should start with our favourite game of the year.
Okay.
Because to me, this is easy. The best game this year was the World Cup final.
I have that down as well. But it's
a contender.
It's an honourable mention.
Oh my god! Is this going to be this going to be some local hockey game that you starred in?
The other honourable mention was United's 3-2 win over Spurs when Ronaldo scored a hat trick, 86 minute header winner. I was at that game, so that's why that is up there for me.
Okay, right.
I think I mentioned that before actually in a few episodes ago. But the one I've actually chosen is the women's Euros final.
That's a really good shout. Yeah, okay, go on.
I watched this at Box Park Croydon.
Mm.
And
is it better than Box Park Shoreditch, which is like purgatory?
It's way better than Box Park Shoreditch, because Box Park Shoreditch is just too small and narrow to like navigate.
And it's full of pricks. It's full of fakes.
Oh, but
everybody there's faking it.
This is full of pricks as well. Generally, but on this day it wasn't. And that's why it was great. So for those who don't know, Box Park Croydon is generally that place where you see all England fans throwing beer in unison whenever England score at any international tournament. Born out of, I suppose, World Cup 2018 was when it started in earnest.
Must have been.
And I was at a lot of those games in 2018 in Box Park Croydon, because it's just around the corner from my house. And the aura at Box Park for those men's games was awful. Genuinely awful. So it was rammed. And it being rammed isn't the biggest issue, but just the aura and the fact that at any moment a fight would break out. Multiple fights at any point in the crowd. England beat, I think it was Panama, 6-1. And then a mass brawl broke out between England fans.
Oh, God.
They literally just won 6-1 at the World Cup. And then they just started fighting each other.
And how is it possible to be angry in that scenario?
But I was like, this is such a horrible atmosphere. Never going to come back to these. And then my work got, you know, a table at Box Park for the Women's Euros. And offered out some tickets with kind of beer tokens and some free food. And I went with Jess. And it couldn't have been more different. Firstly, there were so many families. Obviously, there were a lot of women, which understandable. But there were so many people bringing their young children to Box Park. Everybody was just really happy. There was maybe one or two groups of young men who seemed like they were from the previous crowds, the men's football crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Now you could see like, okay, these guys are very pissed and I suppose could start a fight, but there isn't really enough people here who would engage in a fight for anything to happen, really.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, it was just such a feel-good atmosphere. And obviously they won, which helped. but it was just a really nice kind of like, I suppose, family day out almost, which isn't always, almost never the case with large crowds at football gatherings.
Yeah, we've talked and, about that, that it's like not particularly... So I know people take their kids, but it's not that fun to take their kids.
No. Well, like I have mates who like go to Arsenal, and he's really like hesitant to take his 6 and 8 year old sons because of the abuse that gets thrown onto the pitch from the stands.
Yeah.
And it's just for a kid, you don't really want to expose him to that too much, and it's also quite intimidating, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But With this, the whole narrative, the whole feeling was very, very different. And I kind of feel that that entire tournament, what the Lionesses did, it was kind of a groundbreaking summer for women's football and changed these archaic and entrenched narratives about women's sport, women's football in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of the country were behind them at that moment, which is fantastic to see.
Mm-hmm.
I think obviously the World Cup final was a fantastic, fantastic game, but I think that experience of how different football can be, and also this kind of progression and motion that's probably changed a generation and inspired a generation of young female footballers. So that for me was my game of the year.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it was way more wholesome than the men's World Cup final. But it's But just from the perspective of the actual football, I also would say that the women's Euros final broke new ground in time wasting. The last 10 minutes of the game, when they kept the ball in the corner, I've genuinely never seen it done so well. It was phenomenal, and everyone was really cheering it. And it kind of reminded me, I mean, I know they were dominant in that game, really, but it kind of reminded me of those, when Atletico Madrid were really good and you'd watch them play Bayern or Barca and they'd be defending for like 80 minutes.
Mm.
And it would just be, everyone would cheer every slide tackle. Everyone would like applaud every block. And there was something about that that was really, really fun. I mean, it's not the way you imagine it being played, but it was great.
It's kind of like that, was it Uruguay-South Korea match that was nil-all with zero shots, and Fede Valverde screamed in the face of the South Korean player after he made a slide tackle. Like, celebrated like it was a full-on goal.
And I love that.
Viral over social media, and I was like, yeah, it's great. Really?
Yeah, and why should the celebrations be limited to, like, the strikers because they score the goals? I think I mean, we could come on to this, I guess, because it is related to the World Cup final when it comes to Emi Martinez's behaviour after the World Cup. But I also kind of love that. I mean, Argentina.
I love it so much.
And Argentina are a classic, like, everyone hates us, we don't care kind of team. They were in a weird position in this World Cup because Messi's popularity meant that people for once were rooting for Argentina. But Argentina's kind of hated in South America, certainly. And yeah, as this World Cup went on, I think it became clear that they were the best team. And in the final, they were the best team. But it was also kind of wonderful that France just had enough magical talent to make a game of it. And ultimately, there was pure justice. You know, like, we get to see Mbappe score a hat-trick, only the second player to score a hat-trick in the World Cup final. We also see Messi score twice and be clearly the best player of the tournament. We see France have some incredible moments. I mean, that second goal from Mbappe is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But we also get to see the deserving team run out victors. Because I thought, you know, you look at the game, Argentina were just kind of great. France didn't get going for 60 minutes. When they got going, even then, two pens, I'd say the second one very lucky, and just an incredible goal from Mbappe. To me, it was just everything kind of went right in that final. And seeing Messi deliver Argentina's third World Cup, equal the achievement of Maradona, be pretty much unplayable the entire tournament, ended up with 7 goals and 3 assists in 7 games, which is just bananas, really. I mean, everything about it to me was magical. And then afterwards he goes and kisses the World Cup, and I was like, I just thought, yeah, this is what I've wanted to see all year, and it made me feel really good about it.
In so many ways, it was the perfect final. Probably outside maybe Brazil or no, Brazil, Argentina couldn't have. They would have been a semi-final. In many ways, that was the perfect final. It was the holders versus probably, well, the best team in that tournament.
Yeah.
With Messi, age 36, always been criticized for never winning a, you know, the World Cup. I suppose they won Copa America recently. Last hurrah, last chance saloon at winning the World Cup. Kills it for the entire tournament. Then you have the interesting nature of the comeback. You know, the game looked dead and buried. And then it was like, oh, no, it's not. Two goals in 4 minutes. Game on. Extra time. Both teams score. And then it goes to penalties. Like, in so many ways, it's the perfectly scripted final.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the two best players in the world. The two best players in the world. And it, I don't know. They're just... It was Messi's last big trophy he needed to win. And the fact that he could win it, that it was their third one, that they hadn't won it in so long, that they were up against the holders, that he was up against his club teammate, that he got the same number of goals and assists through the tournament as Diego Maradona did in 1986. Just every single thing about it lined up perfectly. It was like this storm of narrative that also came together in a truly great game, like a game you could not stop watching and where... You really didn't know where it was going to go. I mean, for 60 minutes, we were like, okay, Argentina are going to walk this. And the people I was watching it with were desperate for it to just be straightforward. They were really miserable when France got back into it. Whereas I was excited because I was like, well, I want to watch a good game. The fact we got to watch that good game and Argentina still won, to me, is like a win-win. And it just, it's so rare that these big games are good. We haven't had a good Champions League final in years. I'd say the last World Cup final was pretty good. But generally speaking... Finals of big tournaments, right. KG.
I don't know.
I mean, it had lots of silly... Yeah, but it did have lots of silly stuff, you know, like keepers slapping it into attackers and it just goes in the goal. Like, I love that kind of dumb shit. But, like, this World Cup final had incredible quality as well.
I also really like that Kylian Mbappe won the Golden Boot because, you know, he had a fantastic tournament as well, but... I think on the top line of history books, where he his kind of influence would have largely been forgotten had he not won the Golden Boot. It would, like, if you look at that in 20 years, it would have been Lionel Messi wins the Golden Boot and Argentina win the World Cup.
Yeah.
So I kind of think he deserved at least something because he was also phenomenal in that tournament. And if you look at the Golden Boots over the last, I don't know, five, six World Cups, they've all been like five or six goals. Mm-hmm. So getting eight. In was it 8 and 7 games he had? Fair play.
Yeah, and I mean, his record now is one World Cup, went to the final of the second, and scored a hat trick
in the final,
and scored his penalty. Right? I mean, it was just great, and given there was so much sourness around the tournament, and rightly so, I was at least glad that the outcome of it is that Messi got the World Cup he deserved and, to me, answered every critic who's ever claimed that he can't be the best player in the world, because the best player of all time, because he hasn't won a World Cup. So that was good as well. I felt like I don't have to hear idiots say this anymore. I'm sure I will, but not in good faith.
It was a full stop on... pretty much any sensible point you can make against him being the best in the world.
Yeah. Should we move on to surprise?
Yeah.
What have you got down for surprise? Because I'll give you mine. Mine's a bit boring. Arsenal's title challenge.
Oh, that's on mine. I've got like seven. I struggled narrowing this down. Should I rattle mine off very quickly?
Yeah. Go through it.
So I've got Newcastle being pretty fucking good.
Yeah.
Morocco in the World Cup, Arsenal also being good, Ronaldo's fall from grace, particularly the speed of it. Not a surprise, but the speed of it was a surprise.
Sure, yeah.
Haaland being as effective as he has been in the Premier League, Bellingham's astronomical development.
Mm-hmm.
But the one I've gone for is Brentford's record versus the Big Six.
Okay, well, that's good then, because... off the top of my head, I don't really know how good that is. We can definitely park a couple of those for later. I'll just do my Arsenal thing first, which is I expected Arsenal to go into this season probably be a bit better because they got Gabriel Jesus and I was hopeful about Saliba. And yet they are as good as Man City, pretty much. I still think Man City is slightly better. I still think Man City will probably win the league. That's where my... If you made me bet, that's what I'd bet. But they are clearly one of the two best sides in the Premier League and one of the best sides in Europe right now. It's an incredibly young side. They're playing really good football. And when you think of the football they're playing 2 years ago, you know, when like they just could not score for 7 or 8 games running and it was absolutely diabolical. I can't quite believe that we're here and that it all feels sustainable. I mean, look, if they get... People say, oh, well, if they get key injuries, that it won't be as good. Of course not. If you get key injuries, of course your team won't be as good. That's fine. But fundamentally, Arsenal are playing great football. They've got a team that's going to continue to grow together. If they don't win the title, the only way that the campaign can be a failure now, in my view, is if they don't end up in the top four. I mean, I guess if they finish third, that would feel like a disappointment too. Mm. But it doesn't actually functionally make that difference. If you don't win the title and you finish fourth, like, who gives a shit, really?
Yeah, but finishing fifth would be catastrophic from this point.
Yeah, that would be catastrophic, but that's almost... There are so many circumstances that would have to come together for that to happen. I mean, the fall-off would have to be quite extreme, and a lot of other teams would have to rapidly get quite a bit better, in my view. But obviously, as an Arsenal fan, it's been great. But as well, I think it's been great just because of the fact that it shouldn't really happen. I mean, we're so unused to seeing managers kind of not do a great job. Like, I had loads of issues with Arteta for a long time, and I actually think some of those were backed up. I mean, the team never pressed coherently for ages, which I didn't really understand. There were some weird positional choices that he made. There were some bad signings that were made that were very short-termist. And I think that he would kind of say, well, we had to do that, or I couldn't trust them to press because I thought we'd get cut to ribbons. Given how bad we were, you know, finishing eighth and eighth again, I would argue that maybe it would have been better to at least try and do that stuff a little bit sooner, and maybe we'd have been better sooner. But you can't argue with where it's ended up. I think there were a couple of times in this run where if Arteta had been sacked, you would not have really been able to say that he was particularly hard done by. And now he has turned Arsenal into the best they have looked in about 15 years minimum. It's really good stuff.
I would say closer to 20, honestly. Like that kind Damn. Of early noughties.
Arsenal. What, so we're talking Invincibles?
Kind of, yeah. Well, Invincibles is what, 2002, 2003?
03-04. And then 04-05, we got to the Champions League final.
Okay, so yeah, 17 years. 17
what was that,
06? Years.
Maybe 05-06.
Yeah, you're talking Henry era Arsenal.
Yeah, which is nuts. It's just exciting to see the team play this way. And some of these guys, like the confidence that they have. And, you know, the other night I was watching us against West Ham, and before the game I was like, this is a tough one. You know, West Ham are not a walkover team, and their position in the table, I think, lies a little bit this season. I actually think they're a defensively excellent side who at the moment their attack is a bit ropey. And when they went a goal up, I was like, okay, like this is concerning, because this would have ended in a loss or maybe a draw in the past. And in the second half, it's just easy. Just put up 3 goals, never in doubt, played really good football doing it. Martin Odegaard looked like the best player on the pitch. It's just a phenomenal performance. Even, you know, giving away the penalty in the first half, heads could go down. They just didn't. And to see that belief in players who, a lot of them are 21, 21, 22, 23, then you think, what is this team going to be like at 25? And as a fan, that is what I want. I want a team to make me believe that better things are around the corner. And I do believe that with this team, finally, which is kind of wonderful.
Yeah, it's quite ridiculous how much Arteta has been able to get out of such a young squad. to make them look so, because it's not so much getting them to perform at the top level.
Yeah, it's they're talented, right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's getting them to look comfortable doing it at the top level at 20, 21, 22 years old. Like, Saka looks so comfortable on the ball every time he gets it. Looks so dangerous. And I think when you watch a lot of, like, Arsenal's youngsters, you forget how young they are.
Yeah.
Like your brain or your subconscious almost tells you that they're like a 27-year-old.
Mm.
Just based on, one, the impact they and influence they're able to instill on a top-level Premier League game, but also just how comfortable they look in that role.
Yeah,
you know, the role where it's, you're one of the guys who's going to win this game for us.
Yeah.
And they're just like, yeah, cool. But he's literally was born in like 1999. Probably late, 2001 probably.
Yeah, and Saka especially, you know, like, he only moved over to the right-hand side, as I recall, during the run-in of the 2021 season. I remember he played there and he scored a goal against Wolves. And people were kind of like, okay, we need to see if he can play there. Because if he's going to become a goal scorer as a left footer, he probably is going to need to play on the right and cut inside. But let's see what he can do. And then he had a good run, but we were still kind of like unsure of how good he was going to be in this position. And then during the World Cup, I see people tweeting, Saka is now one of the best right wingers in the world, especially after that performance against France. People were saying, wow, this was a huge performance from a youngster in an enormous game when the chips were down. And I thought, wow, a year ago, people hated him because he missed a penalty in the Euros final. 6 months before that, people didn't even know if he could play on the right wing. And now people are saying that. Okay, that's... As I've said all along, I know I say this a lot, but as I've said all along, if I'm giving up my free time to watch football, I want it to be fun football. And it is fun football. The Nketiah goal against West Ham is outrageous stuff. And it was nice that Wenger was there as well. I don't know. The whole thing was kind of great. So yeah, to me, that had to be the surprise of the year. Because truly, when it comes to Arsenal, I don't really allow myself to believe too much, just because I don't want to be disappointed. So like with title hopes now, we're definitely in the race, but I would never be confident about it.
It's the hope that kills you, right?
Exactly. So just don't hope and just enjoy. And also, you know, if all you care about is winning the title, then you're only going to enjoy football kind of at the last game of the season. The rest of the time, you're not going to enjoy it. So you have to try and enjoy it as it's happening. So that's what I'm choosing to do. And especially after the last few years of watching dire football, then fairly bad football, then okay football, and now I would say really, really, really high quality football, that is pretty sensational stuff. So anyway, that to me is the surprise. That took much longer than I expected. Please tell me about Brentford. And just before we get into Brentford, I would like to point out that Arsenal beat them 3-0 and brought on a 15-year-old when we played them.
I actually saw George Wright's tweet about that.
Which
got me thinking about it, actually.
We brought on a year 10 analyzed against them. How good can they be?
Hasn't even done a GCSE yet.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have a huge amount to kind of delve into here, because I've not delved into Brentford's underlying statistics, but they seemingly have had something. Arsenal aside, they seemingly have had some bit of magic against big teams this, not just this season, but the kind of 2022 in general.
Sure. I think
their last eight games, all competitions dating back to April 22 against the accepted big six, they've got 3 wins, 3 draws, and 2 losses.
God, that is really good.
That is more than impressive. Like, in a league format, that would, obviously some of these are cup games, but in a league format, that would equate to 12 points from 20 of 24 available. So they're going at 1.5 point a game against the league's biggest.
All right.
Which, well, I mean, that's pretty impressive for...
No, for I Brentford. Agree. That's great. Like, over a season, that's like Europa League standard, maybe.
But also, I think if you look at the league this year as well, I think they drew 0-0 with Chelsea. They absolutely pumped United 4-0. That was horrific. Yeah, and they beat City away from home.
Yeah. And, I mean, really, really did outplay them as well.
At what point does... Because you can... you can see like one, two results against a big club being an upset, being a fluke, being just, you know, one of those days where you got it right and they got it wrong, or you had that little bit of magic from, you know, whoever, even Tony.
Yeah.
And that was, that decided the game. The fact that they've, you know, essentially they've lost, they've only lost twice in their last eight meetings with a big six side is quite, it's a, not necessarily a theme, but there's something there in that, in this run, in this squad or whatever, that, I don't know, maybe it's the belief that they believe they should be better, or that they like playing against teams who want to play football, maybe, and the teams that they're playing against maybe at the other end of the table are a bit grittier, or a bit grittier, or a bit, I don't know, just slightly more anti-football, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm making, you know, wild assumptions here. But a sample size of eight games isn't large, but it's, at least in my opinion, large enough to say that there's something there in that group that obviously is working against genuinely top, top sides.
I think they've got a great manager as well. But I mean, it's nice that, given that we've had a pit, we're not coming out of it, but we've just had a period where the best sides in the league have been so outrageously dominant. And I mean, that kind of looks the same this season. It's just that two of those sides are Arsenal and Newcastle. But there was a period in there where these bottom sides were just getting crushed by bigger teams.
Well, you kind of feel like that is the same case with Forest at the minute.
Oh, sure. But it's but the nice thing about Brentford is, rather than just thinking, well, you know, we'll keep it tight, try and get a draw against a big side, and we actually try and get our points when we play relegation candidates.
Yeah, yeah.
Brentford go out to win every game. They really do.
Yeah.
They try and win. And, you know, you saw them against Spurs the other day. They probably should have beaten Spurs. They were the better side against Man City. Even, you know, at Arsenal, they were well beaten, but it wasn't because they were cowardly or conservative, you know. And I know that obviously there's always the argument that this is naive, but they're not naive either. They're a good defensive side and they've got a couple of really dangerous attackers. With Brentford, you just always feel like if they add one special attacker to that mix of Mbeumo and Tony, they could be something really, really exciting. And all that matters is getting that one signing right, because they're still, they recruit well, of course, you know, that's what they've made their names with, but they still recruit a little bit like a top of the championship side, maybe.
Yeah.
I would like to see them just make, if they just went out with one big hit and they were like, right, we've got to drop 30 million on a guy who we think could be a superstar striker. Like, imagine if they'd got Rafinha when he went to Leeds. That would be an interesting situation for me.
I think for a side like Brentford, though, it's kind of, it's tough to do that. It's tough to drop 30 mil on a player, because particularly from a club management point of view, you're always thinking we could go down next season.
Yeah.
And the, of course there are partial payments and stuff, but the financial impact of getting relegated from the Premier League is huge, especially if it comes within 12 months of you like splashing a shit ton of money on a new player who is probably going to go that window or the window after, at least for a cut price, because if they're that quality, they're not going to play in the Championship.
Yeah, but buying that player decreases the likelihood of you going down.
Yeah. But I think there is still a big chance of, well, not necessarily a big chance, but that chance remains more so than a lot of other teams.
But this is why I would say they don't have to go and get a star. I think if you go and get, say, a 22, 23-year-old. So, for instance, Jonathan David has been talked about a lot, but it's possible nobody goes for him and that continues. And then there's a player that you might be able to get where you're not paying him particularly big wages. Because I doubt that someone like Ivan Toney is on particularly big wages, because they got him out, they fished him out of League Two or whatever it was. They fished him out of Northampton. So you kind of think there's a way to do this, which is not too much of a danger. I'm not saying they should go to, you know, Leverkusen or Dortmund and try and get a star off them. I'm saying that they can afford to look at a player who maybe a Spurs would consider to be too big a risk, and they can say, we will give you 25 million for this guy and we'll see what he becomes.
Yeah. I think the next couple of seasons are really, really important for them, because I think their plan as a club will to become a kind of Premier League staple.
Yeah.
That middle.
Are they not that yet?
I think they kind of are, but it seems like it's almost too, they were promoted too recently for them to be like nailed on. They'll always stay up. Mm. It'll be a shock if they go down. I don't think they've reached that level yet. And in many ways, I think the Christian Eriksen deal was perfect for them, because the risk was like almost nothing.
Yeah, like nothing.
It was literally nothing. Like, if it didn't work, they would have just been like, oh, cool, sorry. Contract's done. Like I don't even know what the contract was, but I can't imagine it was over 2 years.
Yeah.
Based on what happened at the Euros. So that was great for them. But yeah, I agree that they should, if they're looking to, it's a double-edged sword, right? They're looking to further establish themselves in the Premier League and become that team that will always finish kind of mid-table, maybe a bit above, but never is really considered as a significant relegation candidate.
Mm-hmm.
To do that, they need to invest. Whether they invest that in, you know, one £25 million player or three £10 million players,
yeah,
I don't know. But I think the next couple of windows are quite important for them. But yeah, I think particularly against the big teams, they've been great this year. And it's
in a way they are the new Southampton. You know, Southampton used to do this. They used to be known for their clever recruitment. They used to have good managers for their level, and because they had a couple of real difference makers, especially in the Tadic Mane era, they were dangerous against everyone. I used to hate it every time we went to St. Mary's against them when Pochettino was there, and even when Koeman was there, we had some nightmare fixtures there. Well, now I look at the Southampton squad and I think, I don't know why I get pushback when I say this. When I look at the Southampton squad, I think it is disgusting. I think it's so bad. They have been in the Premier League for a decade, pretty much at this point, and the squad is atrocious. Now, it's got loads of young talent in it, but those guys are not great yet. They're good. They're good prospects, and you can see the talent on the pitch, but that is not the same as being a good player already. Well, I don't know. Like, they would kill to be where Brentford are, I think, with a manager the quality of Thomas Frank and with a couple of those star players, because that position has now been taken by Brentford and I guess by Brighton as well. And it's nice to see that being intelligent and relatively frugal can still go a long way in the Premier League. You know, this argument that you have to buy, that it's really hard to buy for Premier League clubs because prices go up when they see a PL club appear, it's bullshit, because Brentford have shown time and time again, Brighton have shown time and time again, you can get bargains. So I'm always rooting for Brentford as a result.
I think it's bullshit for the smaller teams.
It's not bullshit for
anybody
United
outside
or
of top six,
Chelsea,
like any
sure.
like top six teams. But also, I think they're, as a business plan, they, particularly Southampton, even though you've mentioned kind of the frailties of their squad now, the fact that they became almost a feeder club for the bigger clubs in the Premier League.
Yeah.
They profited massively off that, because also those big clubs
are willing
to pay huge amounts. They're willing to pay even more because you can ramp it up, because you're saying, oh, we're selling to a rival.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden your like internal Premier League transfer fees just tick up and up and up. And it's for those, a lot of people say the worst business you can ever get into is football. But for those who own the club or who are controlling the purse strings and the transfer budgets, doing that, getting bargains and being, you know, selling them on 3, 4, 5 years later for 6 times, 7 times the price you paid, is a proven model. You know, we just saw it with Cucurella at Brighton, and who else left Brighton as well?
Well, Ben White obviously went for £50 million.
So that's obviously a proven business model that has been successful behind the scenes, but also significantly improved the squad and the team on the pitch.
Yeah. And it shows as well, you know, that what I like about it as well is that it's not fearful. I remember years ago, you know, do you remember when Everton were still had John Stones and it looked like he was going to go to Chelsea? And I remember at the time people said, Everton have to show ambition and keep John Stones. And I remember thinking at the time, that's not ambition. Like, that's being conservative. Ambition would be saying, we can sell John Stones and we can buy a £30 million striker, which at the time would have gone a long way, and a £20 million defender, and we will be a better team because we know how to spend it. Now, if you don't think Everton could have done that, which they probably couldn't, then that's fair enough. But that is what an ambitious team would have done. It wouldn't have just said, we're just going to keep this young centre-back who we know is going to run down his contract and leave eventually. That's not what ambition is. Ambition is actually having a plan to better your station. And I feel like teams like Brighton and Brentford do have that. Brentford are playing it quite safely. Brighton are to some degree as well. But at a certain point, I think it's worth just one big swing. Because I don't think that one big swing on a 23-year-old is going to scupper you financially if you go down. I really don't think it is, because you're not going to pay that player more than 100k a week. And you can manage it if the rest of your squad is on decent salary. And I mean, how much do we think Ethan Pinnock is on? I think that, to me, that's the next step in Brentford's evolution. But should we move on to transfer? Because you kind of... I feel like a lot of your picks there hinted at transfers. So I'm interested to hear who you might have on your list. Because to me, I was really debating it, and then I just came up with one and I was like, oh, it's this guy. No doubt three. About it. Okay, give me your three.
I have Haaland to City.
Sure.
Jesus to Arsenal.
Okay.
But the one I've selected is Martinez to United.
Okay.
Well, all right. What do you have?
I have Bruno Guimarães to Newcastle.
Oh, fair. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Okay, give me your Martinez argument.
Spanner in the works. I still go Martinez.
So, okay. What, he's turned the seventh best team into the fifth best team in the league?
A lot of my arguments...
Well done,
A lot of my arguments exist if we omit the first two games of the season.
Sure.
Right, because...
But that's fine, that happens, especially to defenders.
The first two games of the season, but United as a whole, were abysmal. Particularly, so it was 2-0 loss to Brighton.
Yeah.
A horrific 4-0 loss to Brentford.
They're just bigger clubs, though, aren't they?
Just bigger.
Better managed, better resources, better players.
Yeah. Sign bigger players. Yeah,
so they do sign bigger players. There's a reason Danny Welbeck went to Arsenal, a bigger club, and then an even bigger club in Brighton.
Yeah. So from that Brentford game, okay, United have conceded two or more goals in the league just twice. That was the 6-3 City demolition, which granted was a demolition, and a 3-1 loss to Villa, where both teams' XG was about 0.5 each.
Yeah. Though I would say when you watch that game, they were handily beaten. It was not good.
That's fair enough. But in every other game since that Brentford loss, it's either been one goal conceded or a clean sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And in that period of time since the Brentford defeat, they have the third best defence in the league, conceding 14 goals, which is the same as City. Better only than Arsenal and Newcastle. So, and they're also third in expected goals against.
Yeah, they are.
So it's not like their underlying stats are way off.
No,
Everything's kind of like bang on right about how it should have played out. And all of these signs are, in my opinion, signs of a pretty solid defence.
Mm-hmm.
Again, caveat to that, omitting those first two results, which kind of were awful performances across the board.
But it's like the first two games under a new manager. They were funny, but they're not indicative of anything.
This is what I mean. That's why I... Because they kind of threw a lot of the stats out and make United defensively look a lot worse than they are. Because two games, zero goals scored, six conceded. Mm-hmm. But I don't think those games were indicative of how United actually are as a team and as a defensive unit. And in that same time, since Brentford game, United have amassed the second best points per game behind only Arsenal.
Wow, really?
United's points per game is averaging out at 2.2 since the Brentford loss. Arsenal's. Okay. Do you know what Arsenal's is? Because it's ridiculous.
It must be like 2.6 or something nuts.
2.6.
Jesus Christ.
Which is since game week 3, they've averaged 2.6 goals or 2.6 points per game.
This is one of the reasons that I try to keep a lid on my excitement, because I think gravity always operates on you eventually. Like when Wile E. Coyote runs off the cliff, he doesn't realize he's going to fall for a minute, but then he will fall.
Until he looks down.
Yeah.
And then that's when gravity takes off.
Yeah. And maybe the drop is shorter than you think. So like Arsenal might drop to like 2.3 points a game, but to continue at 2.6 points a game would be so insane. I can't wrap my head around it. It would be like a 30-point jump on last season or something.
Yeah, it would be crazy. But not to backtrack on Arsenal.
It'd be wonderful, Pete.
In that same period, do you know how many league games that Harry Maguire started since Brentford?
One.
Yeah. And then I think he featured for 13 minutes in another game. And he came on two nights ago against Forest. So I think that's quite telling that the Varane Martinez combo is far superior to either the Varane Maguire or even Maguire Martinez. Because okay, if you look do you disagree? Because if you look at United's stats last season, they're pretty dire.
No, but I think to limit it to that, what it would also say to me is that Maguire plus everyone plus Fred or McTominay in front of them is inferior to any Casemiro defense with Casemiro in front of it. Like, I mean, you bought one of the most decorated defensive midfielders of the last 20 years who has looked incredible.
He has, but you're also forgetting that he barely played for the first 7 games he was available.
Yeah, but now you look a lot better with him inside.
We do, but if you look at the...
I agree. If
you look at the stats from last year, and granted, okay, yes, that was a point that I had ready to kind of use as a caveat in that, okay, the defense last season did have a McFred cushion, and now it's got Casemiro and Eriksen.
Mm-hmm.
So that will have affected to a reasonable degree. But last season, United's defense was the 13th best in the league.
Sure.
Conceded 57 goals, which is 4 more than Burnley, who got relegated. And they were 11th best in their expected goals against. So their underlying stats, again, are pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were an out-and-out bottom half defensive unit last season. And right. I'm not saying that Martinez has individually changed that. But if you look at his individual statistics, they're pretty good. As of the November break for the World Cup, and he hasn't come back since, he hasn't played since the break because he's obviously off getting fucking pissed.
Mm-hmm.
Martinez was in the 93rd percentile for possession-adjusted tackles, 81st percentile for possession-adjusted interceptions, 86th percentile for aerial wins percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And 73rd percentile for XG buildup, while averaging 7 unpressured long balls per 90 with an almost 90% passing success rate.
Seems good.
So that shows he's not only at the elite end of defensive interventions, mm-hmm. but he's also significantly involved in the XG chain or XG buildup and consciously playing 7 long balls a game with good XG build up at a 89% passing success.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That he's been as important for your on ball game as he has been for your out of possession game.
He's clearly an elite defender, and he's shown that. His underlying stats show that he is elite as a central defender. But I think what he's added is that it helps that, I suppose, Harry Maguire hasn't been in that position, because they're both trying to play similar positions where they're this ball playing central defender that starts attacks but also has a dangerous kind of diagonal or over the top ball that oppositions need to be aware of.
Yeah.
And has the ability to play that ball to sufficient quality to either at least retain possession but also create a really, really dangerous chance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the fact that his seven, the fact that he's playing seven long, unpressured long balls per game means that he's choosing to play those balls. He's not getting pressed. He's not just trying to clear his lines. He's not just thinking, let's just stick it long, see what happens, relieve a bit of pressure, and move mm-hmm. up the pitch. He's analysing everything on the pitch, and he's choosing to play those balls. And the fact that he's in like the top quarter of XG build-up in the entire league while still mm-hmm. doing that shows that there is a huge element of success, at least in terms of creating danger.
Yeah.
And I think with Harry Maguire, I think he's a decent player. I think he had a good World Cup, but one of the big gripes I had about watching him play for England, particularly in the France game, was he kept trying to play these long, rangy balls. And they were just, you know, 5-10 yards off. They were just going off the pitch. They were just getting intercepted. He saw the ball he wanted to play. Whether that was a right or wrong ball is irrelevant. He still was unable to play that ball to a sufficient quality.
Sure.
And I think Martinez swapping out for Maguire in that role has been huge for United because Martinez actually has the ability on the ball to be lethal or to be really create really dangerous scenarios from really far back on the pitch.
Well, yeah, it's covered for, look, as I say, Casemiro's been great. I think Eriksen's passing's been very important from deep midfield, though I think the quality of his performance has been slightly overrated there because I think quite often people are talking about what they see from him on ball and they're kind of ignoring the stuff they don't see off the ball where he's a bit of a passenger defensively. Not for lack of trying.
No, I said that, like...
Yeah, I know what, you did.
3 months ago, I said that... He was one of United's problems defensively. Because he's not a DM.
Yeah, but Lisandro Martinez, really, you can see why Arsenal targeted him for the role that they've eventually given to Zinchenko, because he just gives you essentially another midfielder while having all the defensive presence of a centre-back. So, and again, it's been nice to have some people shown to be wrong. You know, this idea that, oh, he's too small to do it in the Premier League. It's kind of nice that he's redefining our ideas about what centre-backs can be. But, okay, the path now for United to become a top side again does seem a lot shorter. And Martinez is a big part of that because Casemiro is going to go. You know, Casemiro is not young.
No, he's 31.
You max are probably going to get 3 years if you're lucky, but more like two, I'd say, of this level of Casemiro. The reason I went for Bruno Guimarães is because I don't think there's anybody this season who's instigated as big a change in his club as Bruno Guimarães. Like it was a huge signing for Newcastle to make, and I think people who kind of like followed the stats, and certainly I guess people who watch Ligue 1, felt that it was going to be a big one. But the scale of it, Newcastle was second bottom of the league when he came in. They were 19th. They're going to end the year in third at worst, and when you look at the expected goals numbers this season, everything backs it up. They've got the second or third best defense in the league. You know, Arsenal top, and then it's kind of City, Newcastle around there.
I think they're second from what I was
It depends whose numbers you look at, right? Yeah. But like, yeah, they're certainly there or thereabouts. Their attack isn't quite as good as Arsenal, City, and Liverpool, but it's the fourth best. With guys like Almiron, you know, and I don't want to do down what those guys have done, and I don't want to do down, you know, Joe Linton and Eddie Howe's work there, but Bruno is a transformative talent that side needed in its most important position. And what's interesting as well is that he's changed his role since being there. You know, this was a guy who was always more of a DM, and people still say he plays DM, and he kind of does, but there was a time when he was putting up, you know, six tackles and interceptions a game and passing into the final third 9 times a game, Well, now he's putting up 4 tackles and interceptions a game. He's passing into the final third 5 times a game, but he's passing into the box twice a game. And that's what you see from elite creative players. He's got 12 goal involvements in 30 league appearances for Newcastle. In 30 league appearances, he's got 12 goal involvements. And do you know what Newcastle's points per game is when he's played across all competitions over the last year, given that he joined them when they were 19th in the Premier League?
Is it over 2?
Yes.
Is it 2.4?
It's 2.2. Ooh. 2.2 points per game when Bruno Guimarães plays. That is absolutely outrageous. Like, I can't quite get my head around it. And that he's done it while adapting to a new league, while playing higher, in a side that was, you know, the chips were really down. And
yeah, they really were as well, weren't they?
Yeah, and like, look at it now. Okay, Almiron's in great form. He's got 9 goals in the league this season. I think that's great. Again, showing people up. Though the people who thought he was crap are kind of justified. You see why people felt that way, including me. But if you were playing Newcastle and Almiron was injured, you wouldn't think, oh, thank God. If you were playing Newcastle and you saw Bruno was injured, I would think, thank God, that's their best player. He's gone. And he is a player now who could go to any club in the world and you wouldn't think it was embarrassing that they bought a guy from Newcastle. In fact, they'd be lucky to get him. So to me, that is such a transformative signing. Like, if City hadn't got Haaland, would they have still been title challengers this season? Yes. If Arsenal hadn't got Jesus, would they be title challengers? Maybe not. But I still think the team would have been good.
Yeah.
If Newcastle hadn't got Bruno Guimarães, I don't know if they'd been in a position. I don't know how good they would have been. I think they'd have been better, but I don't think they would have been in the position they were at the end of last season. I don't think they'd have been in a position in the summer to get guys in like Alexander Isak. And I certainly don't think that they'd be the third best side in the league now, but they are. And to me, that is, it's as, it's as close to a one-man resurgence as it's possible to get. Of course it isn't, you know, it never can be. But it's the most attributable to him after Eddie Howe. And
yeah,
I just cannot believe that they managed to do it. If they ever sell him, they could feasibly get 9 figures for him. That's what's been talked about. You know, when Real Madrid were linked with him in the summer, people were saying 9 figures. And you think, well, they're just not going to sell him. But he is going to be the poster boy for that project. If they keep hold of him, he could be the guy for them that Yaya Toure was or David Silva was for Manchester City.
Yeah.
That is so amazing. And more even than that, he's fun to watch. He's just an all-action midfielder that can do everything. He can dribble, completes over a dribble a game. He's a great passer. He's a great creative passer. He's an incredible defensive terrier. I just love everything about him. I think he should have started for Brazil at the World Cup. And I think, genuinely, I can't think of a side that would not be improved by having him in the squad, truly. I think he's on a level with guys like Tchouaméni or Casemiro, certainly. He's a better passer than Casemiro. So, I mean, maybe Rodri, because it's a really specialised role. But if you swapped Partey out of Arsenal for Bruno Guimarães, would Arsenal get worse? I'm not really convinced they would.
He's a player that I entirely forgot about, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. But that is just such an incredible story this year.
I'm literally sitting here trying to think of a player that has been more influential to a team in that period of time. And I suppose if the only thing that comes close to me is Van Dijk at Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but also that's still kind of streets away.
Yeah.
Van Dijk was, and everybody speaks about Van Dijk being transformative at Liverpool. When you look at Liverpool of, say, Lovren era versus the Liverpool of Van Dijk era, which they were probably separated by a handful of seasons, not even. They were transformative. He was a transformative player in that squad and was the reason that they were able to break into this, or, you know, that kind of upper echelon of genuine title contenders. Against City, who are probably one of the best teams assembled ever in the Premier League. But they had a lot more about them at that stage than I suppose Newcastle had when they were sitting in 19th.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they had a lot more to work with. I suppose, I said, I'm saying financially, but I suppose with the Saudis ownership group now, money is irrelevant to Newcastle, or pretty much seemingly irrelevant. But yeah, yeah, no, I think Martinez has been incredibly important in United becoming a better side. Gimenez has been almost, and Eddie Howe have been solely responsible.
Yeah, I mean, Newcastle had a lower start than United. They started the year lower than United. They've ended the year higher. So, should we move on to player of the year? Because, I mean, I could have put Bruno in this. I'm basically not going to bother even justifying this. It's Leo Messi.
Yeah,
he's the greatest player of all time. He's won the World Cup.
My honourable mentions include Mbappe.
Mm-hmm.
He continued to show that he's the second best player in the world.
Yeah.
Erling Haaland.
Sure.
Honourable mention, but didn't want to give it to him because he still hasn't even played 1,500 Premier League minutes yet.
No.
Yet he has scored 20 goals, so, you know.
Did you see the thing that he's the fastest player to 70 goals in top five league history? It was, and he's done it in 72 90s. he's about six 90s ahead of Mbappe and Romario. He's like 10 90s ahead of the original Ronaldo.
I saw that he's the fastest player to 20 goals in the Premier League by seven games, I think. He's done it in 14, and the previous record 14? Was Kevin Phillips with 21.
Yeah. I mean, what's the point?
So he was an honourable mention. I've also got Benzema down here. Does he deserve a mention? Question mark.
No.
Ballon d'Or winner, but a pretty tumultuous exit from international duty. And also, I kind of don't really care about him, to be honest.
I don't care about him. I think he's garbage. Yeah,
so my player of the year is also Lionel Messi. We've touched on it before earlier, but starred in a World Cup winning year.
Mm.
It's really the obvious answer and the only correct answer. Looking at his year, in 2022, all comps, club and country, 51 games, 35 goals, 30 assists. 65 goal involvements in 51 games at 36 years old.
Oh my God.
Averaging a goal involvement every 69 minutes at 36 years old.
And it's also that assist thing as well, I think. You know, that he's played a different role almost. Like, you look at him this season, and he's always obviously been one of the best creators in the world. But this season, he is just sacrificing his own goal scoring in favor of assisting other people. I mean, he's got only Neymar across Europe's top five leagues can match his number of assists. Well, Messi's done it in like 1,100 minutes. He's got more assists than De Bruyne, who's playing behind Haaland. Like, I mean, it's just, why even bother? And then he goes to the World Cup, kills it.
Dominates. Like,
yeah, blitzes past everyone, like truly dominated in the World Cup final. Truly dominated.
That's a big point for me as to why he's the only correct and possible answer for this, because his ability to influence games.
Yeah.
Like, genuinely influence games solely at the age of 36 is almost unfathomable.
Mm-hmm.
You watch him play. The same way I said earlier about you watch players like Saka play and you forget that they're only 20, 21. They seem like they're 27. You watch Messi play and you forget that he's 36. You watch him play and the influence he has and the ease he glides past people, dictates play, and, you know, just scores and assists for fun. You look at him and your brain almost assumes that he's like 29.
Yeah.
Just because of the influence and the dominance he exerts on pretty much any game he's been in this year. Across his career as well, but like, we're talking about this year. So yeah, for me, there's only one ever answer in this. And my actual last point for this section is just iconic. Just one word, just iconic.
Yeah, he is though. And I mean, like, he's the thing that will be remembered from this year of football will be Messi lifting the World Cup. Messi kissing the World Cup. Like, that is what will be remembered. I mean, obviously Real Madrid winning the Champions League, and, you know, but we're talking about, oh, Vinicius, going from being kind of hated and on the way out to Real Madrid being one of the best players in the world, and Mbappe, you know, like being like absolutely unplayable in Ligue 1 and then being the top scorer at the World Cup. But like really what people remember from this year is that the greatest player of all time won the World Cup. And he did it while being the best player at the World Cup, while being the best creator at the World Cup, the best goal scorer, really, I think. Being the best dribbler at the World Cup and doing it all in what really should be the cusp of his retirement. It's absolutely outrageous.
It's the most ridiculous swan song ever.
Yeah, it really is. And you look at Ronaldo, who's a year older than him, and you think, okay, well, Ronaldo's not a useless player, but Ronaldo is now basically going to exit the top level of football.
Yeah.
Messi is
done.
The difference between these two players is a year, but the difference between them is a guy who's done at the top level and a guy who is still the best player in the world.
Is it only a year? I thought it was two.
Oh, maybe it is. Maybe Messi's 35 and Ronaldo's 37. But pretty much. So it's pretty crazy stuff.
Ronaldo was pretty decent last year. Like genuinely
good. Very good.
And then was awful this year. And was pretty dire at the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And has thrown the toys out of the pram. Is going to Saudi Arabia for shed loads of cash. And that's... Okay, he's still going to be playing football, but he's essentially retired now.
Yeah, pretty much.
At least in my opinion. And I could feasibly see Messi do four more seasons. Like, he's that good.
I mean, yeah, it's not even like these seasons could be affecting his legacy, and they're just not.
This 36-year-old Messi shouldn't be playing at this level. And I don't see the drop-off being so steep that he can't still be a very, very useful player at a top level when he's 39. If this is like his trajectory currently, and this is what how he's influencing games, and this is the output at 36, I don't know. I'm very interested to see when he retires. Maybe he just hangs it up at the end of next season.
I would understand it if he did, because
Same. What more does he have to get now?
Well, and also what Messi's always done. Ronaldo was always very clearly, this is going to sound like a criticism. Well, I guess it is. But Ronaldo was always very clearly in it for his own success. And that was fine. Absolutely. Because you're a goal scorer. You want to score goals, and that ultimately results in the team's success. So it's not the worst thing in the world. But what Messi has always done is done what's best for the team. Always. When you watch him on the pitch, he's always he never does stupid things. You never see Messi do something that you think, why did you make that decision? He almost always makes the perfect decision. And so I kind of trust that he'll do that with his retirement as well, but we'll wait and see. Should we move on to the burn book then? All right, well, now we've decided the best player in the world, best player of all time. Should we move on to the burn book, which I struggled with it this week. Do you want to kick off with the burn book? Would you rather start with in or out?
Oh, I'm always putting in something I hate. I'm always straight in that burn book.
Okay, good.
And I also oddly kind of struggled this week, but luckily I've kept a note on my phone of potential burn book entries that I perused this afternoon, and it's probably about 15 long, if I'm honest. But what I'm going to put in this week is the way that bacon and other thinly sliced meats are packaged.
Oh my God.
So particularly bacon, but I will extend it out to things like Parma ham and Italian or Spanish meat selections.
Okay, I'm spotting an initial flaw in that they are not packaged the same way.
I think they are.
Parma ham is normally packaged with a slice of plastic in between each slice so that you can lift it out. Bacon is never packaged in such a manner.
Bacon is the worst of all of these. So bacon comes in this stupid little tray with this film on top that as soon as you open it can never be unshut. It's like fucking Pandora's box.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? As soon as you open that bacon, from the second the knife or the seal breaks the vacuum that bacon is deteriorating. That bacon is getting worse by the second. And if you have 8 rashers of bacon and you are the only person in your house who eats meat, it's going to take you at least a week to eat bacon. And that's being generous. Mm. You're talking like, yeah, also, bacon, oddly long shelf life. Yeah, you could do it, but I don't know if you feel happy about it.
Okay,
Eating 2 rashers of bacon a day for a week.
Is the weirdly long shelf life, is that not longer when it's smoked, I'm assuming?
Well, it lasts longer than raw chicken, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it'll last 3 weeks. So,
ooh.
If you buy it, it lasts with 3 weeks.
Yeah, but it's not something you want to test. But I take your point.
No, I mean, based on the use before date, it's usually about 2 to 3 weeks from when you buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But whereas chicken's like 5 days, 4 days. So surely the concern is better packaging, particularly better resealable packaging, considering you're going to be eating 2 rashers every 4 days, maybe. And then that'll last you. So that'll be in your fridge for like 2.5 weeks. So the fact you can't reseal it.
No, because it's awful. It's 2 or 3 weeks before you open it. Once you open it, I'm sorry, it doesn't matter how well you reseal it. You have to eat it faster than that. And I don't think it's... Is it possible to even make a package that is fully, truly resealable?
Wait, just better.
Do you not have a Tupperware? Put it in a Tupperware.
Well, I shouldn't have to do that. They've provided their own packaging.
And now we arrive at the crux of the issue, which is you've delegated labor to me that you should have done for me. This is your issue here.
If you go to the butcher and get bacon, they give you in a little bag, which is far better.
Okay.
Like a little, it's usually not a Ziploc bag. It's usually just a little plastic bag. Far better.
Yeah.
It's just this stupid little flappy bit of film that ends up just half.
It always curls back.
Yeah, it always curls back. It always
puts bacon water in your fridge.
Half in your bacon, half off your bacon. The half that's exposed goes like translucently. Like no, it goes like rain. Like you know the.
Oh, it goes like fish
like
scale.
Rainbowy,
yeah.
Like
yeah. Iridescent.
Multicolored. Yeah, that's the one. And it's just we're in 2022. We're considering how to put a man on Mars, yet we can't appropriately pack fucking raw pork, right? And to get on to the...
I wish everyone could see how serious you are about this as you're delivering this. This is so good.
To get on to the cured meat section, I think your salamis and so are fine because they come apart quite easy. The issue with things like Parma ham, and Iberico, etc., is that they all merge together because they're packed so flatly, even with those little dividers that they put in.
Plastic.
You still end up just ripping what is essentially half of all the tops that aren't touching the plastic off in one go, and then you're left with the remnants of each individual slice that's attached to the plastic. And then also, even when you take it off the plastic, it rips in itself.
Okay.
And for this one, I have less of a better suggestion, but surely somebody can come up with someone. It's just not good enough.
Well,
it's,
look, you're not one of the little people getting it done.
Yeah.
Your job is to point out the flaws in the system and have somebody else fix them.
Like, can we please stop packaging thinly sliced meat in such ludicrous ways?
This makes me feel so much better about the shit that I put in the burn book, because every week I come in and I basically put someone in that I've had a conversation with that week. So my one this week, and this is a bit of a film Twitter one, but it's when people describe something that is not a character in a film or a TV show as almost a character in itself. This phrase...
This is so niche.
This phrase pisses me off so much. So if you watch any film or TV show that is set in New York City, some reviewer will always say, the city's almost a character in itself. No, it's not. It's a setting. Setting and character are different things. The fact that the setting is important doesn't make it a character in itself. It really doesn't. If you watch The Martian, Mars is an important part of that film. Some would argue it's the most important part of that film. But Mars is not almost a character in itself.
it's a fucking setting. Like, I don't get this argument. And people say it all the time. Anything. Like, it's such a stock response to stuff. Oh, the music is almost a character in itself. The set dressing. I saw a review of Glass Onion where it's like, oh, you know, the sets of this film, they're almost a character in themselves. No, they're not. Characters have agency. They have desires. Characters experience conflict. Characters come into conflict with one another. Like, this is not true of the setting. The setting doesn't have a desire. This is stupid. I hate it. And it's so lazy. And I think what annoys me most about it, and actually this is maybe the, now I'm thinking about it, this is the area in which it connects to everything I put in here, is it's the fake intelligence of it. People kind of say it thinking that they've made some really clever kind of filmy point that I've actually come up with a genius line here. Oh, actually, Kate Bush is almost a character in herself in this Stranger Things scene. Whoa. No, you're not being clever. You're being a tool and you're not actually thinking through what you're saying. I hate it. It's stupid. Can we just retire it? It's kind of like the football version of this. I don't know. Yeah, the football version of this is people saying a player flatters to deceive, which is a phrase I've never heard outside of football. And when you break it down into its constituent parts, it does not make any sense.
Yeah, oh, flatters to deceive.
Have you never heard them say this?
No.
What they flatters kind of mean, deceive. I think, is this player looks like he's going to do a good thing, but then doesn't. So he looks kind of silky on the ball, but then actually doesn't accomplish anything. And they'll say, oh, he flatters to deceive. And I think that means nothing. And I've looked it up. I've actually looked the phrase up online because I was like, you know, because full disclosure, when I was a kid growing up, quite often I would say to my parents, what does this phrase mean? This idiom that I'd heard at school. And my parents didn't know. And that was because my mum had spent pretty much her entire adult life outside the UK. And the time she had been in the UK, she'd been in the north. And my dad was not British. So I remember my sister coming home once and saying, what does the phrase to open a can of worms mean? And my parents were like, I have no earthly idea. So it was stuff like that. And with flatters to deceive, I was like, maybe it's the same thing. Maybe this is just a cultural blind spot that I have. Looked it up, could only find it said in the context of football commentary. So, and again, it's a phrase that like is trying to sound smart. It's trying, it's overcomplicating it, where it could just say like, this guy's being ineffective. Yeah. It's like pure linguistic, like Jenga. It's just we've taken one word and stacked another word on top and maybe that'll work. No, it won't work. That's not how language operates. So it's the smugness of it that pisses me off. So every time that I see somebody say, oh, New York City is almost a character in itself in Sex and the City.
I was literally about to say that earlier because that was my reference. They always say it. They always say that New York is like the sixth character or the fifth. I don't know how many.
The fifth character.
Fifth character.
The sixth character would be sex, presumably.
Well, yeah, obviously. Yeah, I was just about to say that about 5 minutes ago. Is this a review you've read or a specific conversation you've had?
No, it's not a conversation I've had, but I see it all the time. And this is the time of year where people start talking about films and film Twitter.
Yeah, because Oscar season's coming up, right?
Yeah, I guess you start to see, you do kind of start to see the Oscar run, I suppose, between now and kind of February. But also it's the fact that people have got time, they go home, a load of films come out, ready to be watched at Christmas. So everybody's seen Glass Onion and the Banshees of Inisherin is on at, you know, Disney Plus and all this kind of stuff. All these movies are coming out and suddenly everybody has an opinion. And don't get me wrong, idiots who know nothing about film do not have worse opinions on film than film Twitter geeks who are awful. But suddenly everybody starts talking about things like Glass Onion, or suddenly people start offering opinions on actors who they've seen in maybe two films ever, and all this stuff starts to really get on my tits. Because I just think, can you not just approach it as, I didn't like this film, this didn't connect with me, or I did like this film and I found the setting really specific and appealing, you know, rather than saying the setting was a character in itself. Setting was not a character in itself. Shut up. That's my attitude. So this is not a subtweet on this occasion, but it could be. So anyway, that's my take. Moving on to stuff I'm taking out of the book, there's just one thing, which is my daughter has curly hair. my wife has found this hair product that we put in her hair that makes it even curlier. It's called Curl Custard, which I think is the cutest thing in the world. And she gets these little ringlets afterwards, and it honestly is so magical that it's like heartbreaking. And she doesn't realize how silly she looks when she trots around with her little curls bouncing. So that truly, truly delights me. That's all.
Is it like a leave-in conditioner type thing?
It is very much like that. You scrunch it into their hair after we've washed it, and it just, she wakes up in the morning. In fact, even before she wakes, after her bath, we take her through to her bedroom and we put her in her pajamas and her sleep bag and we read her stories. We give her milk before bed. And you can see as her hair dries, the curls start to appear.
The curls starting, yeah.
And that's true even without the curl custard, but with the curl custard, it's pretty special. Like today, her head looked like curly fries. It was so good. So anyway, that's my wholesome pick. And then I'll try and shy away from kid stuff because I know that it annoys people. When I talk about the one thing that makes me happy.
You've unsuccessfully shied away from that topic for 9 consecutive episodes now.
Yeah, and people pay for it. People love it. Give them their slop.
So the thing that I'm taking out of the Burn Book this week is vintage port, but specifically a bottle of vintage port. So this bottle, this was Quinto de Noval 1991 vintage port. So vintage port from 91.
Do you say 91?
91. This was purchased for me by Jess's parents.
Is that the same age as you?
Yeah. So Jess's parents sourced this for my 30th birthday almost 2 years ago now. And we had it in the house, and then I brought it to Bath for Christmas and we drank it together. And it's honestly one of the best things I've drank.
Really? So
there were some lovely raisin notes in it. Unexpectedly sweet on the first day, but it mellowed and was even better on the second day. We drank it over 2 days.
It's even better.
Even better. Really, really lovely bottle.
Better.
Very, very, very good present. They were very, very generous. But it got me thinking also about this mentality that I have loads of like nice bottles of things, but always wait for an occasion to drink them. So, yeah. We obviously waited a year and a half to drink that, and we definitely drank it on the right occasion because I specifically didn't want to drink it without them because it was such a lovely present and Christmas was perfect. But we have like 4 or 5 really lovely bottles of wine in our house that we're like, oh, we'll save them for an occasion. Mm-hmm. And some of them are like 2+ years old.
Yeah.
So I'm now starting to lean towards just being like, you know what? A Friday night is an occasion. Just break it open and have dinner and enjoy it. Otherwise it's, you know, you're going to have it for 7 years and there'll never be an occasion, and then it'll get to a stage where it hasn't been stored properly, so it's spoiled.
So it's kind of like, so it feels like what you're taking out of the Burn Book this week is living in the moment, enjoying life.
I absolutely would not say that, and anybody who knows me knows I would never say that.
You'd post that stuff on your Instagram.
I posted maybe 3 photos in 5 years on Instagram.
If you don't follow Pete on Instagram, all he posts is inspirational quotes over pictures of sunsets.
Just live, laugh, love.
Live, laugh, love. In this house, we speak. I don't know. I don't even know how that one ends.
Would gin is our national language.
Yeah, pizza is my boyfriend.
Yeah. But no, I am very specifically taking out this individual bottle. Quinto de Noval 1991 vintage port from the Burn Book because it was sublime.
Well, I'm glad that you enjoyed it. I'm sad that none of us will ever know what it tasted like, except for its lovely raisin notes. Though I did actually have some port from the 90s myself. I can't remember what year it was, but I know that it was bought by my wife's late grandmother. So it's like 25 years old, and it was delicious. But I did not enjoy it on a significant day. I enjoyed it with macaroni cheese, which I think is how it's done. Like, have you seen the film Sideways?
I reckon his name. I'm struggling to place it, but I think
yeah. So like it's a wine movie, and Paul Giamatti, you know, he has this incredible bottle of wine in it. It's, I don't know, some Pinot Noir or whatever, and he's saving it and saving it and saving it, and then at the end of the movie, he drinks it secretly out of a cup in like a McDonald's while he eats a burger, on his way to go and try and change his life. And I thought, yeah, I like that. I think saving pleasures, it's good to some degree.
Yeah.
But saving pleasures indefinitely.
Yeah.
You know, no, when I think, they could, when you could enjoy them now with people you love.
I think in this scenario, specific scenario with the port, it was perfect because we got to enjoy it in a lovely setting with the people who were kind enough to gift it to me.
Yeah.
I think for so many other bottles we have in the house of just kind of nowhere near of that level, but just other bottles of nice wine, we're always just waiting for a reason to drink them when there is never any greater reason than the fact that you want a nice glass of wine.
We're literally discussing champagne problems, sir.
Yeah.
I think we need to wrap this episode up. Thank you very much to you guys for listening and for all your support across this year. If you would like to support us even more, then head over to our Patreon, patreon.com/PatrickVS, where you can support us at the $2 level. If you just like to kick us a couple of dollars to thank us for making the show. And if you support us at the $6 level, then you'll get access to the bonus episodes. We will catch those of you who do subscribe over on the Patreon only side. Thank you very much for listening. And have a great start to 2023. See you later.